Hi, this is Brent Barber, the founding director of the Bicycle Film Festival, and this is Resonance FM. Ride on until the break of dawn, because you don't stop.
Well, it's good to be back. This is Jack Thurston and the Bike Show, half an hour of bicycle-related broadcasting here on Resonance 104.4 FM. Jen Kerrison is away, so it's just me riding solo. This is the first in a series of shows looking at cycle touring. Long-time listeners to the show will know that that is my major passion in cycling.
It has been a long while since I've tasted pie and ice cream. Nothing but sour cream and black bread most of the time now. But I'm only 900 miles from Constantinople. I must confess to a feeling of homesickness. I am tired, very tired, of being a stranger. I long for the day which will see me again on my native hearthstone and my wanderings at an end.
Well, that was The Last Letter Home by an American cyclist called Frank Lentz, written from the border between Turkey and Persia in the spring of 1894. Frank was never to be heard from again. The letter was read by cycling historian David Herlihy, whose latest book tells the story of Frank Lentz's ill-fated round-the-world journey. 2 years earlier, Frank had set off from the east coast of the United States on a Rover safety bicycle, a revolutionary new design that would soon consign the high wheeler or penny farthing to obscurity. It was the birth of the bicycle as we know it today. And Frank Lentz can be counted as one of the pioneers of cycle touring. Tonight's show features an extended interview with David Herlihy. I began our conversation by asking him to describe why this new bicycle, the Rover Safety, with its two equal-sized wheels and a chain-driven variable gear, was sparking a second bicycle boom.
The high-wheel era is really very male-dominated. Occasionally, society women use tricycles, but because of the danger involved, really, of riding one of those high-wheelers. Whereas the safety bicycle, which was, of course, called that because it was considered safer if you fell from one, that had a far more general appeal, and it was something that even women could ride. It really opened the doors to tremendous expansion of the cycling community, and Lentz, in a way, was sort of an evangelist promoting this new style bike.
And the bike that Frank Lentz was riding around the world was a bike that we'd recognize as a bicycle today.
Yes. I mean, it certainly was a lot heavier. It was 57 pounds. You wouldn't want to ride a bike that heavy today around the world. And it didn't have any gears, except, well, it had, I should qualify that, he could change gears in a sense. He had two different size sprockets on his rear wheel, so he could stop and flip that wheel around, reattach the chain, and get a lower gear. Nevertheless, the basic form, the frame, the two equal-sized wheels, had a very modern look about it.
And he was riding a bike with pneumatic tires.
Right, and that was very bold on his part. That was even newer than the safety bicycle itself. That was the latest innovation because the first safeties had solid rubber tires. So this was quite a leap, and it was technology that ultimately sealed the fate of the high wheeler because it wasn't well suited for the high wheeler, but it worked very well with the safety with its two equal sized smaller wheels. And Lenz was quite bold, and because it really had just come out, and nobody had tested these pneumatics over long distances. But he was very technically minded, and he realized after some experimentation that this vastly improved the ride.
Let's talk about Frank Lenz, the man, a young man. Tell me his story. Where did he grow up, and how did he get into bicycling?
Well, his parents were both German-born. They emigrated to the United States right at the close of our Civil War in 1865. Frank was born 2 years later in Philadelphia. His dad was a cigar maker, his mom a homemaker, and it seems that his biological dad, Adam, died when Frank was just a toddler. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a death record, but what we do know is that at a certain point, his mom remarried another German-American whose name was William Lenz, so Frank Reinhardt, as he was born, became Frank Lenz when William adopted him. But unfortunately, it was a very rocky relationship, and according to the family lore, William was an alcoholic. So there was a kind of backstory to this whole round-the-world trip that the world didn't know about. He projected a very happy-go-lucky, kind of almost naive image. But he was actually from a very troubled home, and a few of his letters home reveal that he had what he called a miserable existence with his home life. But professionally, he did pretty well. He was an accountant, trained, he had to learn good penmanship and obviously the rules of accounting, and got himself a pretty good job that paid $1,000 a year, which was a pretty good sum back then. And, you know, the high wheeler, his first high wheeler, I think, cost about $150, so still a sizable investment. But he, being a bachelor living at home, he could swing that. And he was kind of a new breed. You know, the penny farthing, as we call it today, sometimes the culture was often quite elitist at the beginning. But more and more people like Lenz, who were not from wealthy backgrounds, were getting into the sport at the time.
What do you think attracted him to the sport?
Oh, I think he loved being outdoors, you know. So there was, you know, and again, partly because he wanted to get out of his unhappy home. He loved the fresh air. Pittsburgh was a grimy city at the time. It's cleaned up itself a bit now, but, you know, known for steel and other industrial products. And that's one thing the bicycle, the high wheeler, did, was it allowed young men to escape, you know, to get out of the city into the fresh air of the countryside. So, you know, and he loved the physical challenge. He dabbled in racing, even though he wasn't really the right height. You know, the sport favored tall people. He was only 5'2", but he was explosive, and he actually won a number of races.
What was the racing scene like in those days? What kind of distances were they racing over?
For the most part, he did 1 to 2 miles, so they would go around ovals, and these would be events organized on the weekend. They were amateur events, so there was no money involved. There were some prizes offered by the clubs that organized these. Occasionally, there would be a road race, but sort of the highlight of Frank's racing career was when he entered into an unprecedented 100-mile road race between Erie, Pennsylvania, and Buffalo, New York. That turned out to be kind of a fiasco because of the weather conditions. The entire course was reduced to a swamp, and Frank actually should have won that race, but he came in a disappointing third, and I think that was kind of the turning point when he decided he was more interested in touring than racing.
So he is part of our great tradition of cycle touring.
Oh, absolutely.
He loved it. He wasn't just doing it as a stunt, as a way of burnishing his reputation as an athlete. He really enjoyed the touring aspects.
He did, and he undertook, before the world trip, a couple of long-distance tours with a great pal of his named Charles Petticord. And so he had his summers off. He had a month off. So in 1890, he went from Pittsburgh to St. Louis along our national road, which was, you know, really nothing more than a dirt path. And then the next year, in 1891, he went to New Orleans, and he brought his camera, which was quite a bulky affair. He actually was using glass plates at the time. Film wasn't quite on the market. He relished the whole thrill of touring and being somewhere different and meeting people. And, you know, he had read Thomas Stevens was sort of the original globe girdler, fellow who went around the world in the mid-1880s on a high wheeler. And Lenz wanted nothing more than to emulate Thomas Stevens and get a sponsor.
Let's talk a bit about the photography side of things, because he was a keen and very ingenious photographer. Mm-hmm. And what do you think he liked about photographing his exploits?
Well, I think he was definitely drawn to new technology. You know, you really had a convergence of two technologies there. Not too many years before, the whole process of developing glass plates, they called it the wet process, and it involved bringing along a lot of chemicals, and so it wouldn't even have been practical. So now, with sort of the new dry plate technology, it was becoming possible for cyclists willing to carry, you know, a certain load to be photographers as well. There were very few wheelmen who did that, and I think he really loved both technologies. And I think he also realized at a certain point that if he was going to get a sponsor to go around the world, this was a real strong card to play. You know, he could propose to take photographs. And magazines were at a point where they were starting to publish photographs, so it all kind of came together for him.
So when did the germ of the idea to ride around the world come to him, and how did he make it happen?
Well, I think it actually came in the fall of 1888 when he did that race from Erie to Buffalo and finished that, you know, disappointing third. The next day he lingered. There was an industrial fair in Buffalo, and he came across Stevens's bicycle. Stevens had just returned from his round the world journey, and that bicycle, a Columbia penny farthing, was on display. So I think when he saw that, it really triggered this idea, wow, that's really what I want to do. You know, no more racing. I want someone to pay me to go around the world. So that, I think, was the beginnings of the idea. Of course, it wasn't that easy to attract a sponsor, because it didn't seem very novel proposition following Stevens's feet. But Lenz kept at it. But he decided to focus on sort of building his portfolio of photographs. And his real break came with the introduction of the safety bicycle, because the opportunity to ride that is what really made it novel enough to attract a sponsor, you know, to get Outing magazine behind it. The same magazine had sponsored Stevens, in fact.
Well, let's turn to the journey itself, and while obviously we won't go through every twist and turn, because it is beautifully described, if I may say, in your book, and people ought to read that for themselves, let's just sketch out the rough outline of the route. He starts on the east coast of the United States and heads west. Mm-hmm. And essentially this is almost a processional for the first part, isn't it, where he's very popular, there's publicity, he's got a press agent going yes. ahead of him. It's all pretty good, right?
That's absolutely true. Yes, and so that was an unusual decision, to the idea of going west instead of going east the way everyone else had done up to that point. It's not quite clear why Frank decided to do that, but it did allow him to sort of do the easy part first, the 5,000 miles across North America, although there were some tough times there, too. I mean, trying to cross the far west, you know, in the middle of summer had its own difficulties, but he knew that at least he wouldn't face hostile citizens the way he might, you know, he was expecting to in Asia. He starts out by going through Chicago, where he observes the Great Columbian Exposition is being constructed at that time. He couldn't, of course, hang around for it. Then he went to Minneapolis, and then he follows the Northern Pacific Railroad line all
the way.
Because
there's no roads.
There's no roads. In fact, he actually often rode right between the rails, which doesn't seem like a great surface, but, you know, it was better than the alternative. So, you know, the only problem was occasionally he'd run into a train. In some cases, he was on a bridge and didn't have time to kind of get out of the way. So he more than once, he kind of dangled himself off the side of a bridge while a train went, you know, overhead.
So this is kind of Buster Keaton stuff.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, that's what you had to do. I mean, and he was very well received by the men and women, the wheelmen and wheelwomen of the day, every time he arrived in a new city, and they drew quite a few banquets for him. And actually, the last one in San Francisco, he got a little carried away. He got drunk with beer and had to spend he cursed out a cop, was thrown in jail for the night, but he sobered up and caught his ship to Japan. And he'd spend a month in Japan where he was he really loved that country, the beauty of it, and found the people very friendly. And he did have to adapt culturally. Certain things like men and women bathing together shocked him. But, you know, that was a relatively easy sailing. And then the real tough part of the journey was when he arrived in China in the fall of 1892, and he had to cross that country right during a wave of anti-foreigner riots. And he was advised by numerous knowledgeable people that it would be foolhardy to try to bicycle across China, but of course he went ahead with it anyway.
Because he took a kind of central route, if you like, heading towards Burma and then India, where perhaps the more cautious route would have been north through Mongolia, would that
be right? Yes, yeah, the Allen and Sokleben were, you know, they also crossed China, but they did do a northern route to across the Gobi Desert. And that had its own challenges, but for the most part, they didn't have to deal with hostile, citizens, whereas Lenz went through the heart of China and following the Yangtze River. And there were times when he even walked his bike at night to avoid a detection. I mean, he was so concerned for his safety, and he would draw enormous crowds, and sometimes they were threatening. His route was quite daring. He basically followed the telegraph poles all the way to Burma. That was about 3,000 miles. And he really wound up walking most of that because the western part in particular was quite hilly, and yeah, he simply, and it was winter by this time, so he really was not able to do much cycling at all. So he thought he was going to get across China in 2 months and would take him over 6.
You paint the image, perhaps unintentionally, of a man on his own walking his bicycle across these mountains in China, but actually he was often accompanied by hired help sometimes even carrying his bicycle, right?
That's right. He hired, they were called coolies at the time. They were basically manual laborers. And so because he did have so many hills and mountains to get over, he did hire a team usually of 2 or 3 who would help him. Actually, you know, they'd strap the bike on a pole and march it over. You know, he was also kind of a stickler. You know, he would let his help at times take the boat down the river, but he refused to do anything like that himself. You know, no trains, no boats. It had to be done on his own speed. You know, if he walked, okay, but it was going to be on his own speed. That was, you know, he really was very rigorous about not cheating on this trip.
As a foreigner in China at that time, this was a pretty difficult place. People would be drawn to him at all times. He was reliant upon getting food from local people, a bed for the night. What were the kind of coping strategies that he managed to come up with to deal with difficult situations and to keep going without running into too much trouble and to meet his daily needs?
Well, I think one thing he learned very early on, you know, he did have a revolver with him, you know, for safety purposes, but I think he realized that that was really a last resort, you know, that firing a shot in a crowd was probably not a good idea. You know, he'd stay at these inns. He really, for the most part, found them quite filthy, but he had no alternative, really. And wherever possible, he did stay with missionaries. You know, a lot of them were English, so a few were American, and they would always take good care of him and give him advice about where to go.
He talks almost boastfully of only knowing two words in Chinese, the word for food and the word for bed. But there's some quite endearing passages where he talks about resorting to humour and entertainment as a way of breaking down barriers, mm-hmm. that he accepted the inevitability that he would be an object of curiosity. And he had a little puzzle that he would give people once they'd had a good look at his bike, and so he'd give him a bit of a break and he'd then solve the little puzzle and they'd all, you know, laugh, or he'd start playing his harmonica that he was carrying, or doing little things like that to reach out. And so while on the one hand he's quite hostile and unsympathetic to the Chinese and almost, you know, doesn't regard them as properly human, there is a point at which you feel like he's reaching for some kind of common ground with these people and appreciating a sense of entertainment, even if it is only a means to an end for him.
He does express some solidarity with the Chinese. He understands their anti-Western sentiment, even if he's a victim of it. But you're right, he did have a number of techniques to bond, if you will. In some cases, it was just really just a way, the puzzle and the harmonica was a way to sort of distract them, you know, while he could sit down and have a meal. But one of the great, you know, scenes, I think, in the book is when he is surrounded by this mob with peasants with pitchforks who, for some reason, you know, had decided they didn't like Frank's presence. And he realizes he's really cornered. So he gets on his bicycle and he starts to do tricks, like standing up on the saddle while riding. And he's able to get a few laughs to break out in the crowd. And then next thing he knew, the whole crowd broke out into laughter. And that diffused the anger. And he was able to make a polite getaway at that point. So, you know, I think you get the sense Frank was someone who could think on his feet. And
well, he makes much better progress crossing India, in large part because of the decent roads that have been put there by the British colonial rulers. He also seems to enjoy the food much more in India, and that takes him through Afghanistan and Persia, right?
That's right. It's about another 1,000 miles that he crosses in Persia, and he's quite captivated by that country, its beauty and its wealth. And, you know, he actually found the food rather tolerable, and the locals as well. So I think although he was way behind his original schedule, he was feeling pretty good by the time he reached Tabriz. You know, he basically just had to cross the country of Turkey, and then he'd be at that would be his Istanbul, then Constantinople would be his gateway to Europe. And he knew Europe would be pretty smooth sailing, and that would really be the end of his trip.
But he never makes it.
No. Sadly, when he's in Tabriz and he meets with the crown prince, the future Shah invites Lenz over to his palace. He's an avid photographer himself, so he's captivated by Lenz, and he actually winds up taking one of the few pictures that Lenz didn't take of himself. The one that's on my cover is the last known picture of Lenz in that courtyard in Tabriz. And at that point, he's advised by missionaries and diplomats to avoid Turkey because the caravan road across Turkey was well known to be treacherous under the best conditions to foreigners. But there were also growing reports of Armenian unrest along the route. So Lenz was advised to take a northern route through Russia to avoid Turkey altogether. But because he was in such a hurry, he was really... I think he was getting homesick, frankly, and he really just wanted the quickest way to Europe. He was very much looking forward to visiting relatives in Germany that he'd never met. They were planning a big reception for him. And I think, you know, he was very excited about the idea of reaching London. He knew that was the birthplace of the safety bicycle, and the British cycling magazines at the time were following his trip, so he would have been royally received here without a doubt. But you're right, he doesn't make it, sadly. In fact, he doesn't get very far into Turkey when he disappears.
The last third of the book talks about the investigation that followed into what happened to Frank Lenz. And it's quite another kind of swashbuckling episode, because one of these previous globe-girdling cyclists, William Sachleben, perhaps for reasons of self-promotion, but also out of, I sense a sense of doing the right thing and wanting some adventure, decides to go off and try and find out what happened. Did you ever get to the bottom of the story of what happened?
I have to be honest, I don't think so. That is, I do suspect that Lenz was killed, and quite likely by Kurds. But whether it was the Kurd that Sokleben accused, I think the evidence is not certain there. So I had to admit that it kind of remains a bit of a mystery, and compounded by the fact Lenz's actual remains were never found, or the bicycle. So without knowing exactly where he was killed, it's difficult, or where he died, where he's buried, it's difficult to come to any firm conclusions.
Did you see your mission as to tell a positive story about Frank Lenz? Because in a sense, the coverage of him when he came back was that, well, he wasn't doing anything that hadn't been done before, and he was a bit of a foolhardy guy who didn't take advice and got what he deserved.
Yes, I think that's true. At first, when he disappears, a tremendous amount of sympathy for him. But I think that did wane over time, rather quickly, actually. So once the public kind of got over the initial loss, yeah, I think the general consensus was that he had been foolhardy, that he shouldn't have crossed Turkey alone on his bicycle. So I think that contributed in part to, or accelerated his fall from fame, if you will. I think part of that had to do with the decline of the bicycle, the rise of the automobile, the fact that these round-the-world trips on bicycles to some began to seem rather quaint and outdated. But I felt, looking back, that the story had been forgotten, and there was something to it. I mean, I think that, first of all, it should be recognized that Lenz was on the cutting edge. I mean, he wasn't just reacting to the bicycle boom. He really helped to spark it. You know, he's trying to promote this new style bicycle to the public, trying to show that it's a practical machine that anyone can ride, and that's a lot of fun involved in it. And he succeeds in that level, I think. And had he returned to Pittsburgh, he certainly would have been welcomed as a hero, and he probably would have had a very promising career ahead of himself. Maybe not so much as a cyclist, but he could have transitioned, like a lot of his peers, to the the emerging automobile industry, perhaps. Or, you know, he had a lot of options ahead of him. So, you know, I don't think, in some ways, his trip wasn't quite as foolish as it looks in retrospect. I think he did make some errors, of course, errors of judgment. You know, overall, I felt, yeah, there is something inspirational about his story, and it shouldn't be completely forgotten.
I was in conversation with David Herlihy. His book is entitled The Lost Cyclist. It's published in the UK by Mainstream Publishing and in the US by Houghton Mifflin and Harcourt. It's available in all good bookshops and perhaps in your local public library as well. Well worth a read. That's it for this first edition of The Bike Show in this Olympic year, 2012. We'll continue this touring season in the coming weeks. If there's something that you'd like to hear about in a cycle touring vein, or if you've got your own touring adventures that you'd like to share, please get in touch via email. The address is bikeshow@resonancefm.com and on Twitter @thebikeshow. The One Life Left crew are up next with a whole non-stop hour of video game fun. Monday nights don't get much better. Keep it tuned to Resonance 104.4 FM. Goodbye. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. I want to take this moment to tell you about an event that I'm hosting on Thursday this week, Thursday the 19th of January. I'll be in conversation with Graham Obrey, a legendary British cyclist, world record holder for the hour and world champion. Graham will be down in London to talk about his new training manual, which has been recently published. And it's a fantastic read, very idiosyncratic, as you'd expect from Graham, a man who built his own world record-setting bicycle and through his own researches into aerodynamics and body positioning on the bicycle, revolutionised his sport in the late 80s and 1990s, and of course had that fantastic rivalry with Chris Boardman. Graham began his cycling career cycle touring around Scotland with his older brother Gordon. As I often say, at the heart of every great cyclist is a great touring cyclist. So come down to Look Mum No Hands on Old Street to meet Graham and to listen to him and me chewing the fat, talking about cycle touring and probably his training manual as well, as well as his life on two wheels. It'll be a great event because Graham is a fantastic and captivating man with a lot to say about cycling. It's from 6 o'clock. Graham will be there from 6. And then I think shortly after 7, 7:30, we'll be on stage at Look Mum No Hands doing a bit of chat. And obviously you'll have a chance to ask Graham your own questions as well. So hope to see you there this coming Thursday, 19th of January at Look Mum No Hands. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.